From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A bad roommate, an entertaining friend, a man in love, and just married. That's how three of the September 11th hijackers were described by people who knew them. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Terry McDermott of the Los Angeles Times about his research into who the hijackers were, what radicalized them, and why they attacked the U.S. McDermott's new book is called Perfect Soldiers. Also, we meet Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker from the trio Low, a group that was initially dubbed Slowcore because of its slow tempos and grinding guitar sounds. Their latest album is called The Great Destroyers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What were the motivations of the men responsible for September 11th? Journalist Terry McDermott has traveled around the world and spent years doing research trying to answer that question. His new book, Perfect Soldiers, tries to explain how men who were mostly from apolitical and unexceptional backgrounds became extremists. McDermott is a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. One of the 9/11 hijackers McDermott profiles is Mohammed Atta, who is believed to have piloted American Airlines Flight 11 from Boston, which attacked the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Atta grew up in Egypt and went to Germany to attend college. I asked McDermott how Atta was radicalized in Germany.
First of all, he was a more active participant in the religion than he'd ever been in Cairo. His family in Cairo didn't even go to mosque. His mother didn't wear a scarf or a veil. In Germany, he began to associate with people at one particular mosque that had a very radical interpretation of Islam. This mosque called El Quds, the preachers frequently called upon the congregation to drop their lives and join the jihad. And this was not a metaphorical exhortation. They were asking them to go and fight. And Atta became more and more enamored of this idea. And he and a small group of friends spent enormous amounts of time talking about where they should fight, what it meant to fight, what their obligation was. Literally years they spent talking about these things. And so the process, these guys, I thought, you know, I would try to find the person who recruited them into the cause. But they weren't recruits, really. They were volunteers. I mean, they recruited themselves.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the person who proposed the idea to bin Laden back in 1996 of flying a plane into a building. Can you talk a little bit about what that original proposal was like and how Mohammed became the person to talk to bin Laden about it?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is a ethnic Pakistani who grew up in Kuwait and went to the university in North Carolina. And when he returned from there, he went to Afghanistan to fight in the war against the Soviet Union, which ended soon after he got there. Not long after that, he and a nephew became involved in a series of plots, almost none of which were executed, but all of which aimed at Americans and/or American allies. The plan for the ideas came about when they were in Manila in late 94 and early 95. They developed an idea to hijack commercial airplanes over the Pacific Ocean and blow them up with everybody aboard dying. The plan was to have five or six people hijacked a couple of different planes, and they would plant bombs on board, and then at intervening stops would get off, and the planes would fly over the ocean and crash. That was interrupted by Philippine police, and the co-conspirators were all caught, but Mohammed never was. And he kept the idea, and it went through various iterations. By the time he brought it to Al-Qaeda in 1996, the idea had changed from simple hijackings to taking the planes over, piloting them as missiles. He proposed doing this to bin Laden, who wasn't quite so sure it was a workable idea initially.
What was bin Laden's objection?
It's too complicated and too hard to do. He wasn't so sure that the bombers could plant bombs and then get away. Of course, the great innovation of modern terror is finding people willing to not get away, finding people willing to commit suicide in the participation in these plots. So the plan morphed into this idea of hijacking planes, putting their own pilots aboard them, and then using them as targeting them toward their destinations.
So did Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and bin Laden decide together that the thing to do would be to recruit suicide bombers to fly the planes into buildings?
They did. In fact, bin Laden had pilots in mind, or people who would be pilots in mind already, and he nominated four men to lead the missions, two Saudis and two Yemenis. At that point, the idea was that two of the flights would be flights from Asia and two of the flights would be flights within the United States. So the two Saudis went to California, and the two Yemenis went to Malaysia. They were never able to bring that plot about. I mean, they had visa problems. It quickly became apparent that the Yemenis were bad to have in these plots because it was hard for them to get visas to go anywhere. So the plot changed again, and they looked further for pilots who could get into the United States and train. And that's when they found Muhammad Atta and his friends.
How did they find Atta?
Atta delivered himself. He and his friends from Hamburg in late 99 decided, as I said earlier, to go to Chechnya, and they were told the best way to get to Chechnya to fight the war against the Russians was to go through the training camps in Al-Qaeda. And they were told how to do this through Pakistan, and they went. And they arrived in Kandahar and were immediately seized upon by bin Laden as recruits for the planes operation, as 9/11 was called, within Al-Qaeda. I think the thing that excited them about these men's potential for this plot was, one, they were somewhat technically proficient. Otto was a degreed architect and urban planner. And also, being an Egyptian, it was easy to get a passport visa to the United States. He also spoke fluent English and German. Most of the people in the Al-Qaeda camps didn't speak any other language other than Arabic. And most of them came from places that it was harder to get visas to America from. So I think Otto was from Egypt. Another fellow, Marwan al-Shehi, was from the United Arab Emirates. A third pilot was from Lebanon, and the fourth would-be pilot was from Yemen. As with the earlier men from Yemen who tried to engage in the plot, the man from Yemen never got a visa, so he was never part of it. The other three got into the United States and went to flight school. They eventually found a fourth pilot. Again, he just walked into the camps one day, a Saudi, who was already a licensed commercial pilot.
Did you get any sense of whether Atta or any of the other pilots at any point during the planning period had any second thoughts about dying for this mission?
Yeah, I think some of them did. I think Atta himself, before he left for the camps in 99, two things happened. One, in the autumn of that year, he asked for a private meeting with a friend of his, a German friend, a Muslim convert in Hamburg, a younger man who Atta had mentored somewhat, and he warned the man to beware of radical interpretations of Islam, that the man should live a holy life and follow the Quran, but be wary of anyone who tried to enlist him in other causes. And within weeks after that meeting, Atta, having just received his graduate degree, went home to visit his family. And his mother was ill at the time. She had developed diabetes. And he asked, before it was time to return to Germany, he asked her if he could stay in Egypt and take care of her, to forego further studies. And she said, no, your father, who wants you to earn a doctorate, is right. You should go to America and get a PhD. So it indicated some willingness to be talked out of this.
My guest is Terry McDermott, national correspondent for the LA Times. His new book about the September 11th hijackers is called Perfect Soldiers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry McDermott, national correspondent for the LA Times. His new book, Perfect Soldiers, profiles the September 11th hijackers and analyzes their motivations. One of the people you spoke to was Muhammad Atta's former landlord. And she told you that she felt in danger just being around him. He'd look at her wearing a sleeveless shirt and you know, just be incredibly angry over that. Was she afraid to talk with you? Did she think that if she talked to you, somebody else who was a militant Muslim would get back at her?
I think she was more afraid of the media. There are so few people who knew these guys.
No, afraid to talk to you. I mean, you are the media.
Right, but I protected her identity. But she was afraid of talking to anybody for fear that her name would be revealed.
Right.
The two roommates, two men who lived with Muhammad Atta over a period of 5 years, one for 3 years, one for 2 years, have never been interviewed by anybody except me. And it was, you know, you're sitting there in Hamburg, you know, beating your head trying to figure out who can we talk to, who can we find, who actually knew them. And the people who had talked prior, like, knew him for a week or a month or 2 months. And you're thinking, the guy lived here for 7 years, you know. He had who did he live with? But you couldn't even get the names of the guys. German privacy laws are very harsh, and you can't get anything. Reverse telephone directories are against the law. I mean, that's how hard it is. A criminal's name can't be published in a newspaper because the name belongs to the criminal. So just finding these guys was just extraordinarily difficult. And they didn't want to be found because they were afraid of just becoming besieged by the media hordes. Finding them was just, in some ways, a stroke of luck. We knew where the house was, where they had lived, and we knew the house manager, and we'd talked to him more or less politely initially about trying to get the names, and it was against the law, so he wouldn't give them to us. And after a couple weeks of trying other ways and not getting anywhere, myself and my Arabic translator, my German translator, dressed in black from head to toe. I'm 6'1", 200 pounds, and these guys both are much bigger than me. Uh-huh. And we walked into this guy's office, and my German translator, Dirk, handed the guy, we'd rehearsed this ahead of time. I said, just give him my card. Tell him we want the information. We know he has it. If he gives it to us, we'll go away. And this is just pure stupidity. We walk in, Dirk hands him the card, says, we know you have the information, we came to get it. The guy reaches in his desk drawer, pulls out a file, and says, is this what you need?
I think you say he pulls out a gun.
No, he pulled in, here's a file with the guy's names and phone numbers, where they lived, and we tracked them down, and they agreed to talk.
So what'd they tell you?
Well, that's where I think this the basis of the image of Muhammad Atta that is in the book comes from these people who lived with him and knew him fairly intimately. And that is this sort of aggressive insularity. They hated him. I mean, and one of these guys was like the most laid-back kind of college guy you could ever meet. You know, he just likes to go out and have a beer, and he's got a ton of friends, and he laughs.
These were his roommates when he was in college, not when he was,
right.
You know.
That's correct,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
In college in Germany.
In Germany. Mm-hmm.
No, not in Cairo. When he was in college in Cairo, he lived at home. These were college in Hamburg roommates. And this guy lived with him for 2 or 3 years and just grew to hate even seeing him. They shared a kitchen. They each had separate bedrooms, but they had common rooms or kitchens and bathrooms. And Muhammad would walk into the room when the guy was there with his girlfriend and not acknowledge anybody else even being in the room. He never washed the dishes. You know, simple roommate stuff, right? He didn't wash the dishes. He hated to eat, but when he would cook, he would like boil a whole pot full of potatoes, mash them up, sprinkle them with cumin, then eat them right out of the pot. And when he was done with that meal, he'd just stick the whole thing in the refrigerator. And the next time mealtime came around, he'd walk to the refrigerator, pull out the pot and eat some more and stick the fork back in it. It was just, on the most basic level, was a bad roommate.
Do you think information like that helps us understand how Muhammad Atta became a suicide pilot on September 11th?
I think what it helps us understand is the classic phrase, the banality of evil. I mean, there's nothing particularly exceptional about these people. They did exceptionally bad things, but they're normal people, and they're as screwed up as everybody else, and they're not uniformly bad or uniformly good. Marwan al-Shehhi was, everybody liked to be around him. You know, he was constantly, he carried candy with him everywhere he went, a little bag of candy. He gave candy to all of his friends. He'd sit at the table and sing jihad songs or sing songs about how happy it would be to become a martyr. Happy-go-lucky, I guess we wouldn't call that here. But among his group of friends, that was it was regarded as quite entertaining. I think the personal information tells you the degree to which they were more or less normal human beings, and the degree to which there are many more or less normal human beings who would do something similar. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has said that Al-Qaeda was oversubscribed for martyr operations, more martyrs than there were plots to put them in.
You know, in terms of whether any of the hijackers had any reservations of dying for the mission of September 11th, one of the hijackers was actually in love and had recently been married. Tell us about him and how you think that his marriage may have affected his decision to participate.
Yeah, the man you're talking about is Ziad Jarrah, who was a Lebanese young man from Lebanon, from Beirut, who had moved to Germany in 1996 for university and fell in love with a young Turkish-German Muslim woman. And they were they became romantically involved very quickly after they met in 1996 and remained that way until September 11th. In fact, the last thing Jarrah did before he got on the airplane that morning was to call her. She was in southern Germany, in Bochum, southern Germany, and he called and said, "I love you," three times and hung up the phone. I think, you know, because of this relationship, it's often been supposed that Jarrah was more torn about the decision than others, and or less certain about the decision, and that he had something else to live for. And I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think that misconstrues the nature of the beliefs these guys had. You know, committing suicide, martyrdom, to them was not at the cost of your life. It was the signifying act of their lives. It was something. He wrote her a letter that she got after the attacks, and in it he told her that she was proud of him. Not that he didn't apologize to her. He wanted her to know that he did it for them. It's an indication of the power of these beliefs, I think.
Did you meet any members of the hijackers' families who regretted the fact that their son or brother or cousin was part of September 11th?
You know, in any horrific crime or big disaster, as reporters, you go out and you meet people. They talk to you largely because of remorse. They feel some small degree, maybe, but some degree of responsibility for the bad thing that happened. That if they had only done this or that, they could have prevented it. And in the course of interviewing probably 500 people for this book, I don't think I met five people who expressed that remorse. Many of the members of these men's families are still in denial about their participation in it. Those who are not in denial felt some, not responsibility, but just utter bewilderment about it. I must say, within the Arab world, which is sort of governed by myth in a lot of ways, it's almost pre-rational society, and myth plays a powerful role. And one of the overwhelming myths there is the omnipotence of the United States and of the CIA in particular and of the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. If it was 10 people, it was 200 who told me that this could not have happened had it not been planned by the Mossad or the CIA. It's not a casually held belief. It's you see it in the front pages of newspapers. People still refuse to admit what actually happened, or not the events themselves happened, but who did it. And this includes the families of the hijackers.
Has writing this book about the September 11th hijackers affected your experience of flying and how you look at people who are on your plane or who are checking in?
Well, it's expected. It's writing the book hasn't affected my experience of flying. The effects of 9/11 have greatly affected my experience of flying. It often now takes longer to get on a plane than it does to fly. I mean, it's made it harder to get on an airplane. I'm not sure it's made it harder for people to blow up airplanes. It has affected my view of strong beliefs. I'm not a religious person. I was raised in a religious household, but haven't ever practiced religion. And, you know, the thing I learned from the book most was how dangerous is the idea that you have the one true belief. And I think that the people who think they are in possession of the one true way for anything will do horrendous things to achieve it because they think everything is justified. I mean, I think religion is a great thing. It gives people comfort, many people great comfort. But it wrongly wielded, it's a horrible, horrible sharp sword.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Terry McDermott is national correspondent for the LA Times. His new book is called Perfect Soldiers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker, founders of the trio Low, a group known for its slow tempos and grinding guitar sounds. We'll talk about changes in their music and what it's like to be in the rock world as a married couple, Mormons, with a baby.
I can't decide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The trio Low was originally known for its slow tempos, quiet sound, and close harmonies. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says, slowly, steadily, much like the music they're best known for, Low has become one of the most dependably surprising, revelatory rock bands. My guests are guitarist, singer, and songwriter Alan Sparhawk and drummer and singer Mimi Parker. They recently toured to promote their latest CD, The Great Destroyer. Life on the road for them is different than for many bands. They're married to each other, have two children, and they're Mormons. Their latest CD departs from the quiet, slow sound that they're known for. Here's everybody's song from the CD, The Great Destroyer. I asked Alan Sparhawk about the change in Low's sound. He told me that when Low was formed nearly 12 years ago, he had an almost rigid sense of how it should sound, and he wanted to sound different from the other bands he was hearing.
When we started the band, it was essentially just myself and a friend of mine kind of exploring the possibilities of minimalism. We were fans of Brian Eno and some of the post-punk things like The Cure and Joy Division, even some of the quieter Velvet Underground records. And we just kind of started experimenting with playing as little as possible. And I think kind of somehow roped Mim into the band by promising her that she wouldn't have to do anything too crazy. And here's a drum and a cymbal. Just play these two things and we'll play really slow and quiet. And I don't know. I mean, starting with that extreme has been interesting because you're essentially starting from the beginning with nothing. And at least in hindsight, I'm seeing that over the years, we essentially started from playing nothing and over 12 years built to a point where we finally feel like we can play anything.
Mm-hmm. Did you like having rules to strain against?
Yeah, I think the greatest accomplishments, essentially in history and of humanity or even nature, have been because they were either, you know, someone or something was left a limited amount of resources or possibilities or ways in which to form the universe, and when you have those limitations, those are the times when you're pushed to. Mm-hmm. Go beyond yourself and come up with something that's
hopefully
beyond what mm-hmm. you could have done had you had everything in hand.
At your disposal, sure.
I mean, I don't know. I spent a little, I mean, like in undergraduate school, spent a little time in the art department. I was a horrible drawer and I couldn't paint, but I was really fascinated by the concepts of it and the way professors would teach you. And I remember being really excited about, it's like, okay, for the next 3 weeks, you're only painting with black and white. And to me, that immediately made sense. It's like, well, of course, we're gonna learn way more if we just use black and white than we would if we just said, here's a bunch of paint, kids, give it a try.
Mimi, Alan said that he had to convince you that it would be okay to join the band. You just have to play a little cymbals and drum.
Yeah.
But, you know, first of all, that neglects to mention how wonderful your singing is and how much you'd be singing in the band. So what kind of music were you making before Low?
You know, Low is actually the first band I've been in. And I was in, when I was in high school, I played in the marching band. You know, that's my experience. I played snare in the marching band and... So very, very limited experience. My family was kind of musical. We would, you know, my mom had a guitar, and she had aspirations of being a country star. So she had a guitar, and we would kind of just sit around and play music, and that was my role, was always to come up with harmonies, because she and my sister would usually sing the lead. So I, from the beginning, I kind of, I don't know, I just learned how to listen and kind of draw and come up with harmonies.
I want to play another track from your new CD, The Great Destroyer. And although we're talking about, you know, like the new sound on the new CD and how things aren't just, quiet and slow, mm-hmm. as they were on most of your earlier records, there are things that are, in fact, fairly quiet and slow on the new CD. For example, the song Cue the Strings. You want to say anything about this song before we hear it?
I don't know. It seemed anyone who's followed us for the last 6 or 8 years knows that every record, I always seem to have one song where I'm really, really trying hard to be Roy Orbison. And I don't know. For some reason, I've always just been infatuated with his song structure, his songs that just begin and build and build and build.
And then
it's done.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've always loved that, and this is the song for this record that is that element. But I don't know. I kind of worked it out on a little cheap keyboard. It's not very Roy Orbison.
Okay. Well, let's hear "Cue the Strings" from the new Low CD, "The Great Destroyer."
Before you speak.
Music from the new CD, The Great Destroyer, by the trio Low. My guests are Alan Sparhawk, who is a singer and guitarist with the band, and Mimi Parker, she's the drummer and other singer with the band, and they're also married to each other. And one of the things I love about the track that we just heard is your harmonies on it, and how your vocal harmonies also match with what the instruments are playing. And there's these nice held notes, and when you just hear these harmonies kind of suspended, you know, in the air and you know, resonating really nicely.
Thanks.
What's your process like for figuring out the vocal harmonies and how you want the vocals to harmonize with the instruments?
I usually kind of come up with some chords and the basic melody for the song, and then, I don't know, just sit around with Mim, and she usually comes up with at least the first harmony pretty quickly, and mm-hmm. then I don't know, if we add anything like third and fourths, it's usually just...
It's usually just off the cuff. It's just in the studio and...
Trying to get fancy.
Yeah.
But...
I was going to say, it seems to me your harmonies need to be pretty precise in this kind of singing. Because it is often slow.
Yeah.
The long-held notes is something that we've... I forget sometimes that people just don't sing that way. You know, I mean... I don't know, we've just, early on, because of the slowness of the songs, we've developed this ability to hold long notes and kind of hold these steady, close harmonies, and it's something really that we developed just from practicing and working. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not something that's natural to me. Mimi for sure has, I feel, a natural sense for harmony, and she has a very smooth voice, but I think one of the weird things is that Well, one of the factors there for sure is that, I mean, we've known each other since we were 9 years old.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
We've been, yeah. Yeah, we've known each other since 9 years old, and we've been dating essentially since.
Yeah, we're high school 16. Sweethearts. So maybe we've just.
We've been listening to each other.
Way too long.
Yeah, for so long. it's just easy for him to fall in and follow my phrasing and. Fluctuations mm-hmm. and stuff.
So you met when you were nine. How did you meet?
I showed up for fourth grade. Mm-hmm. We had just moved. My family just moved from Utah to Clearbrook, Minnesota, and showed up for fourth grade with the other 28 kids, yeah. And there she was.
Wait, so mm-hmm. were you boyfriend and girlfriend in fourth grade?
No.
I think he had a crush on my best friend, actually.
First girl I kissed.
Yeah.
My guests are Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker of the trio Low. Their latest CD is called The Great Destroyer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker of the trio Low. Sparhawk and Parker are also married. Low's latest CD is called The Great Destroyer. Here's another track from it called Monkey. Monkey, the opening track from the new CD, The Great Destroyer, by the trio Low. My guests are founders of the group. Alan Sparhawk is a singer and guitarist. Mimi Parker is a singer and drummer. Alan, what is the monkey in the song?
Oh, boy, now you're getting personal. I don't know. This record was written during a lot of confusion of my own I don't know. It's that moment where you're sitting there going, "That's it. This has got to break right now." And that's that song. And I don't know if I've really written anything like that in the past. Usually, it was always writing about something that happened, and your feelings about something that happened. You know, I don't know. Monkey is all right. That's it.
In the moment.
In the moment. Mm-hmm. This has to stop now.
What kind of confusion were you going through?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
mid-30s.
Mid-30s, let's see.
The
time of your life where people buy Corvettes. Some people go do this or that. But for me, I just plain kind of. Lost a few of my mental capabilities. Spent a little time in the hospital, and now I'm doing a little better.
You spent a little time in the hospital?
Well, not. I don't know. I don't want to go into it too much, but nonetheless, the last couple of years I've been, it's been an interesting mental struggle, and it's kind of strange to be sitting here talking about a record that essentially illustrated that whole time, and it's a weird feeling. I mean, a lot of artists have bored many a public about their struggles, but I don't know. What are you going to do? This is my way of expressing things, and it's exciting. I'm glad it turned out to be a good record, because it could have been really, really horrible.
So was it like an emotional crisis or a musical crisis or something that precipitated whatever this was?
Well, I think honestly, it was. I'm still kind of working out what it is with some therapy, but through meeting with the people that I've essentially had to meet with because of mental illness, I've learned since then that this is a common thing. Men sometimes in their 30s can't hold it back anymore, and if there's something they're dealing with from childhood or not dealing with, it tends to exercise its leverage a little more in when a male gets in his early 30s, and I don't know if it's depression or bipolarism, though. That's when that stuff sets in, usually with a lot of males, and at least that's what I'm learning.
So that was like the issue, depression or bipolar disorder.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Depression, mm-hmm. You know, suicidal, so to speak, and then just the process of coming to terms with that and realizing that's enough. I can't do it on my own. I need to go get help, that's been a long process, and it's been so far positive. And the fact that I'm still here speaking,
mm-hmm. And pretty much this whole record was written during that time.
So it's interesting, because especially being in the middle of touring right now, I mean, to get up and play some of these songs I get to review my breakdown, so to speak, here every night. But strangely enough, it's actually feeling pretty positive.
you know, the something I often wonder about, and I know a lot of people do, is like what's the connection with an artist? What's the connection between their artistic gift and whatever like emotional or mental issues they have that might seem extreme? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So like if is like the music connected to the depression, and if so, like what?
Oh, which comes first, the suicide or the Ozzy Osbourne?
No, but you know, like there's a certain almost obsessive quality to being an artist that also has its kind
drives
of downside.
One mad.
Yeah, that has its real downside in the rest of life.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a strange thing. I mean, I try not to think about it too much, because if you're in the middle of it, the last thing you need to be doing is doing any romanticizing of it, mm-hmm, necessarily. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a really strange thing to write or to create or to make art or whatever, where you acknowledge that there's something higher kind of inspiring you. And that feeling, that sense that there's something else coming into you or through you as an artist or as a creator or whatever, I think there's something about that. It's kind of like, you know, if the window's open, every once in a while the wind's going to blow in stuff that's not going to be so easy to get out of the carpet, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think just... Yeah, the same struggle that inspires an artist to do what they do. I think about 95% of it never goes away, and after a certain point, you know, it can be pretty strange, dangerous, and ugly. I mean, there's a lot of, and we know a lot of musicians who were essentially our contemporaries 5-6 years ago, who are either really having horrible time right now, or they've, you know, at some point turned to drugs or alcohol and are lost in that, or they've just had to just walk away and really be away from that part of their life to function and to go on.
Mimi Allen was talking about like his depression that this record grew out of, and man, when you're with someone who's depressed, that means a lot. It's almost like how your life is changing because of that. So, stop me when this gets too personal.
Okay.
How did this period kind of change your life, both in just as not only as a wife, but as a member of the band? I mean, did you have to convince Alan to play more, to come back to the band?
No, I never had to convince him of that. That was never really an option for him. He's very driven person when it comes to that, and personally, it's just been challenging. You know, just been challenging to. It's kind of hard to separate the marriage from the band sometimes. You know, unfortunately, they, for good or for bad, they kind of get intermingled. And if there's a personal issue between us, it's kind of hard to not make that a band issue.
My guests are Mimi Parker and Alan Sparhawk of the trio Low. Their latest CD is called The Great Destroyer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker of the trio Low. Sparhawk and Parker are also married. You're both Mormon, right?
Yes, we are.
So, you'd think that there'd be part of, like, you know, the rock and roll ethic, you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing, or the music scene in general, that would so go against your values. So has it been hard to, or challenging, to kind of redefine the music or the scene for yourself in a way that... That it kind of suits...
Works.
Yeah, it suits your
beliefs,
personalities and your values and your life.
Well, when you come into making music from kind of the underground DIY ethic, I mean, there's only going to be 5 people at your show anyway. Why bother with the trappings of making sure it looks like a rock and roll show or that it functions like a rock and roll show? I mean... I don't know. I mean, we'd get in the van, go play. You, just because the drinks are there, don't mean you have to drink them. And we get back in the van and we stay with friends and we
never
go to
really
church
been,
when we can. And
it's never really been a problem.
No,
I think.
In fact, most of the we've met some really crazy, hairy,
rock and rollers
over the years. And most of them are a lot mellower and a lot more morally aware and clean than you would think. I mean, I think it would surprise most people. The rock and roll myth is alive somewhere, but man, we haven't found it anywhere in 12 years. So,
what has it been like for you to have a new CD? And I'm sure you've wanted to tour for it. I don't know how much you've been able to tour, but at the same time, you have a baby now, so you know touring is probably much more complicated than it ever was. So, how are you trying to manage, you know, being the parent of a baby with touring?
Well, you First, you just have the baby.
It's a crazy combination.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you think about it too much, you would never do it, you know, because it's kind of daunting thinking of all the things you have to bring, the preparation.
If we were to explain to you how hard it would be, no one would ever pack up their children in a van again.
We're working out the bugs right now, but with the second child, it definitely has added a new level to the touring experience.
Yeah.
But fortunately for us, he's a very good baby, so he kind of just goes with the flow. And really, you just do it. You just pack them up and you just do it, and they will adjust.
Yeah, kids will adjust to anything. It's the parents that.
Yeah, it's the parents.
Have the problems. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, Ellen Sparhawk, Mimi Parker, thank you both so much for talking with us, and good luck to you both.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Sparhawk and Mimi Parker of the trio Low. Their latest CD is called The Great Destroyer. You can hear a couple of tracks from it on our website, freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. Here's more from Low's CD, The Great Destroyer.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Creating a Legacy of Physical and Emotional Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former Army Sergeant Eric Saar worked at the detainee camp in Guantanamo translating Arabic for guards and interrogators. He translated for one female interrogator as she used sexual tactics on a Saudi detainee, which Saar found quite disturbing. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Saar and Vivica Novak, who co-wrote his new book about Guantanamo called Inside the Wire. Join us for the next Fresh Air.